Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week we bring on David from Secret Handshake Toys and talk through his story, how he got to toys, what he's making, what's up next, all the good stuff. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can follow us on all socials. So we're going to find out all the drops and all the good stuff at Toys on Tap, wherever you get socials. If you want to support the show, you can jump on the Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. It's where you get extra goodies. We're still working on some stuff there. Also, if you want to support the show in a free way, please, we want to take over the world. Like, subscribe, rate, review. Throw me a rating or a review. Get this out to more people. Because we love you, and you love us, and we want more people to love us. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. What's up, David?
How's it going?
Good. Dude, I'm pumped to have you on. I figure after seeing you so many times at these different shows, it's time to get you on.
For sure. You just need the audio from this, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, because my lighting is horrible, as you
can
tell.
I like the streams that are coming.
I have this weird, like, mid-modern light yeah. source, but it's just, like, behind me kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So it is hideous.
I'm pumped that you're on. I'm pumped that we got to work it all out. Yeah, I won't post any of the video, don't worry.
And that's kind of what I figured, because I've listened to a few and I've basically, like, I'm not sure if you post a video anywhere that I know of, kind of thing.
No, yeah, I used to, but it becomes so tricky because you can't, we have things like this will happen. And I can't navigate it. So it's like
your setup is perfect because you have like everything right there. But I'm just here at my laptop and I'm like, well, this is where I'm going to be. I could set up somewhere else, but I don't want to unplug my Cintiq. I don't want to unplug anything else.
Yeah. Kind of I still am trying to figure out, like, you'll notice I have one glare right there. There's just no way to do, like, I can't figure out the way that my room is positioned, how to do that. And so it's whatever.
I get you.
Yeah, it's the worst. Hey, but I'm glad you're here. This is an episode all about you. We're going to record everything you say and hold you accountable later. So cool. Please, like every episode, please introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you do.
Yeah, I'm David Kaufman. I'm a longtime toy collector, more recent toy maker of Secret Handshake Toys. I also work in animation. So yeah, everything kind of art related, character driven is really my vibe.
Is the connection between you and Tony through animation?
We worked in games together. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Both like toys at the time.
So I was collecting a ton of toys at the time and I would be getting them delivered to my work.
Yeah.
And
I do that too.
And it's just way easier. And so, like, Tony would be seeing all the stuff that I'd have come in. And at the time, he was really into Muscle, the little Keshi yeah. dudes, Kinnikuman, Man, if you're Japanese. That's kind of where he was at the time. And just like both of us just like feeding off each other, like from animation, toys, et cetera, kind of thing. And we became good friends basically through that.
Yeah. I do want to walk back all the way to childhood like I do the other artists.
Too far.
But I got, like, tell me about your collection. If you're a longtime collector, that means you've got some stuff.
Let's skip a little bit of childhood. No.
Okay.
Like childhood, it's very much like every other 80s kid. Like He-Man leads to Ninja Turtles leads to whatever's next, grow up leads to what I have now, kind of thing. So I feel like a lot of us are really similar, but I feel like I grew up kind of without cable, without like really video games. All of that was like a secondary source from like I'd go over to my cousin who had like all the video game consoles, like Nintendo, PlayStation, etc. growing up. Like, I never really had that. And we never had cable at my house because we lived like on a weird farm in the country kind of thing. Not weird farm, but a farm in the country.
Yeah.
So cable was just really expensive still at that time, and cable was still relatively new. Like, we had HBO like on a box for a short time, okay, kind of thing. So like Fraggle Rock was the only thing I'd watch on HBO at the time, kind of thing.
Yeah.
In terms of that kind of stuff, like, it, like, I always like grew up with Saturday morning cartoons, cereal, the whole tradition kind of thing. That's most 80s, 90s kids did.
Yeah.
And I think stuff didn't really hit me until later in life when I like went off to college and started like seeing, oh, cable TV, Cartoon Network, Dexter's Laboratory, and then later Samurai Jack and a lot of these other really amazing, really graphic.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So, yeah, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You got to check it out.
Toy Rats.
Toy Rats.
YouTube.
Bye.
UPA, Hanna-Barbera inspired, but 90s, yeah, early 2000s cartoons kind of thing. So a lot of that was really like the first thing that hit me from like a, I don't want to say professional standpoint because I'm in college, but like a more like grown up standpoint of like cartoons are more than what? I don't know exactly, yeah, kind of thing.
I mean, before we get too deep into that, tell me about farm life. That is so crazy.
So
to think about.
So yeah, I grew up in Gilroy, which is like
I'm from Fresno.
Right off 152. If you know the area of California, it's about half an hour from San Jose, 45 minutes from Santa Cruz, an hour from Monterey, an hour and a half to 2 hours from San Francisco. So like you have all these coolish cities or kind of cool cities nearby. But until you're like old enough to drive, you are in the middle of nothing kind of thing. So I grew up on a farm, 4-H FFA kid kind of thing. But I was also an artist. So I'm like this weird crossover between like country kid and artist kid. So like very much a nerd, very much didn't fit in with like a lot of crowds kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like the country kids are all like, you're not redneck enough for me. Or I don't know how to say it any other way kind of thing. And then like the art kids are like, you're not artsy enough for me kind of thing. So I had like a few core group of friends kind of thing, but obviously like I'm still pretty nerdy. So there's that going for me. So I definitely had this core group of just friends that like I could trust that I grew up with that kind of became my thing. And I think I've kept that along the way. So speaking specifically about on a farm, like we had oat hay and pigs and sheep, and that was primarily it. I don't talk about it too much because obviously like not many people relate to it living in LA. it's weird. I don't know. Like, it's one of those things that I grew up with it. It gave me like an amazing work ethic. I did a lot of manual labor growing up as a kid, just because I'm on a farm working kind of thing. But obviously like my artist calling was much bigger, I guess, than that. So I went into that, and
are you the oddball because you went into art?
Yeah, okay. Definitely. I don't think like there's been like my great grandfather like is supposed was who I never met, was supposedly an amazing photographer kind of thing, but like no one else in my family was really an artist growing up. So even like when I was applying to colleges, like my mom was like, shoot for graphic design because there's so many graphic design jobs, and I'm like, yeah, but I don't really fit in with graphic design. I'm like, I want to go like illustration or I want to go animation kind of thing. And it's just like a foreign language to most of my family. Even to this day, like they, like I explain what I do and they can see I'm passionate about it. And even toy making, like I explain what I do and they see I'm passionate about it. And they just like have like a, almost a misunderstanding of like what it is, or they just can't fully relate to it in a lot of ways, which seems weird.
Yeah. I've kind of given up trying to explain toy making. There's yeah. no,
well, that's the thing. It's like, I understand you work in animation. That's an actual job. There are actual jobs there. What you actually do in animation, don't understand.
Yeah.
But we know that's a job because we see the end result. But with toy making, it's like, you do what now? And I'm like, it's a side thing. It's never not going to be a side thing. I have fun doing it. I have a crazy collection. You should know that too, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that is a whole nother story, is like the whole collecting mentality. And my parents have known I've been like a collector my whole life. So that doesn't surprise them. But specifically collecting Japanese vinyl is like a whole newer, different thing for yeah. them, even though I've been doing it for 15 years.
I can't imagine you having to explain that, coming from that type of a background, to then say like, no, there's a whole part of the world that makes art and toys that's all I want to collect.
Exactly. No, and that's the thing. It's really weird. And obviously, like, it's not like it's a huge thing that comes up like around my parents or my family in general. It's just one of those things that like I do it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
My wife appreciates it and likes it enough to let me do it too. So it's one of those things where like I have a group of friends that understand it and have been in it for as long as I have, or not as long as I have, or longer than I have, kind of thing. So we definitely build our own like little community around it, kind of thing. Cause I think even like if you go out in the regular world, most people aren't going to understand it or really super relate to it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's tough. Take me back to college.
Yeah.
You see Dexter's Laboratory, you see those things, yeah. which if this is, I mean, our age gap here, I was a child with watching those things.
Yeah.
Like you're seeing those for the first time in college.
Yeah.
And so does that kind of pivot you completely towards animation?
Definitely. Obviously like there's other things that like lead up before that. Like I didn't have cable, but like a bunch of my friends are huge into Ren and Stimpy. So like I see the aesthetic, I see a few episodes and I get like the whole yep. appeal and I gravitate towards it kind of thing. And obviously SpongeBob and stuff like that too. But really Dexter's Laboratory is the one that hooked me 100%, honestly. And you talked to Tony Bowie. So,
yeah.
So a lot of my education, I went to San Jose State with Tony.
Okay.
So a lot of what he said is exactly it. Like, from an education standpoint, from a personal standpoint, like went to San Jose State, close to home, far enough from home that I can live on campus kind of thing. And I think it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, first time like experiencing life outside of my family's house kind of thing.
Yeah.
And just really wakes me up to like, there's so many other people out there that are art driven like me, Obviously in high school, I have friends who are art driven too, but not like in the same way that I am, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or in the specific direction that I am, because animation is such a specific thing. But yeah, I think that's what really motivated me too, was just the idea of like, there's this whole school of, or community within this school of art and design that is animation illustration driven. And even though everybody wants to go into little different facets of that world, we're all kind of together and get each other.
Yeah, it is. And it's a very specific style. If Ren and Stimpy and Dexter's Laboratory, the things that are grasping you, that's a very...
I mean, I say Ren and Stimpy just because it was like I never really like gravitated towards Ren and Stimpy other than it was like the first thing that really came up in terms of like a creator driven show, but on a cable network. So they had a lot of freedom, but Dexter's Laboratory specifically, and to a lesser extent, Powerpuff Girls, really was my jam, like in 1998 to 2003 or something like that.
8 to 12 years old. Yeah, that is cool. I think that like getting into those or finding joy in those and then trying to find your avenue to those is an incredible journey that kind of builds people quickly. So you're headed that way. What does it look like to explain that to farm parents that are like, we want you to be a graphic designer, and you say, but look at this.
I think it was a pretty easy switch, just because like, I think it was one of those ideas where like my parents just didn't see that those jobs were out there. Cause I didn't even really see those jobs were out there until you see it at a college. And even when you're in college, you're like, okay, animation, it's so daunting. But then you see like it's so compartmentalized. Like I do prop design, and that's really all I stick to, kind of thing. So I'm doing prop design, somebody else, well, I'm doing prop design, and there's other people on the team doing prop design, and then there's people doing character design, background, color, storyboards, directing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a whole production team that's organizing all of it. So like just the idea of like understanding that and seeing like this little thing within this bigger thing, I think really helped my parents understand that there were jobs out there. Plus they were seeing like, well, there's whole networks, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like that are being built just for animated content, kind of thing. Plus you have Disney, Pixar, et cetera, kind of exploding at this time, because Pixar was really exploding during the mid to late 90s, kind of thing.
Yeah. That is.
And DreamWorks was exploding out of that then too.
Yeah. That is an interesting thing to try to not only be interested in it, but then to have to explain like these things exist.
Yeah.
So you're fully into it. Toy collecting at some point, like tell me if it doesn't cross over, tell me about exiting and finding that first animation job or something in that realm.
So, let's talk more a little influence wise. Cause like, as I'm getting into Dexter's Lab and all that, I'm also crossing over into like Juxtapose artists at the time, which is like all the early 2000s lowbrow artists like Gary Baseman and primarily Tim Biscup, like huge into Tim Biscup kind of thing. And so I'm seeing like more routes that I can take, and that's just like kind of branching out where I can go in terms of when I graduate. And so Hallmark recruits from my school, and I get this job as an animator at Hallmark somehow. The greeting card company. Yes.
Yeah, great. That's awesome.
So basically, e-cards are pretty big at the time. It's like 2004, 2005. E-cards are getting big. They're trying to think of different ways to make animated content. And at the time, they were trying to create licensed characters. And so I was on this team for at Hallmark in Kansas City, Missouri, of all places, growing up in California, moving to Kansas City, Missouri, to get my first job at Hallmark Cards. Heck as yeah. an animator, which is a job that also doesn't fully exist there. They have a lot of designers, they have a lot of illustrators, but the actual animator job doesn't really exist and probably doesn't exist anymore. But yeah. there were like five or six of us that held it at the time. And it was really cool and weird and interesting, just because you're going to a place that like really respects artists and illustrators and has like a foundation in so much. It has a foundation and so much depth in terms of like really letting artists like find their voice and breathe, kind of thing. Yeah. Which was what was really cool about working at Hallmark. On the flip side, it's a super, super, super corporate company. So so yeah. you have like the corporate side of and the logistics side of it too. Which thankfully, like as an artist, I kind of avoided getting involved with at all, kind of thing.
Is this before Hallmark movies?
No, Hallmark Entertainment is a separate division.
Okay. Okay.
They have Hallmark at this time. They have the Hallmark channel. It is based out of LA. But it is completely separate from Hallmark Cards. It's yeah. owned by Hallmark, but it's a completely separate thing for okay. the most part. Yeah.
That's crazy as a first job. I yeah. like
really weird. Kind of funny.
Cards as a thing. That part doesn't even, that's not the crazy. The crazy thing is that they wanted their own characters. Like what kind of character do you want?
So,
crazy thing.
So in the '80s, Hallmark created Rainbow Bright.
Mm-hmm.
They also created, the Shirt Tales. Yeah. Shirt Tales, which is basically, so Hallmark and American Greetings have like a back and forth. American Greetings creates Rainbow, or American Greetings creates Strawberry Shortcake
mm-hmm.
to compete with Rainbow Bright. And then American Greetings creates Care Bears to compete. And Hallmark, as a result, creates Shirt Tales to compete with Care Bears. Obviously, Care Bears wins.
Yeah, I don't even know what Shirt Tales is.
Yeah, so, exactly. Shirt yeah. Tales, they're a bunch of animals. They wear t-shirts with sayings on them. Weird. So in the 80s, yeah. Hallmark had a lot of like potential to make content. And so did American Greetings. American Greetings also created like Mad Balls and stuff mm-hmm. like that, which is where like James Grohman comes in and has worked with like American Greetings before and stuff. So you have this 80s background of them being able to create like characters and animated content, and they want to kind of get back to that. So they have these two characters that have gotten a lot of online attention called Hoops and Yo-Yo. They're a pink cat and a green bunny. Really just improv based. So it's a lot of like back and forth of improvisation. It really works well in short form, long form, who knows? It
yeah.
may work, but it has ceased to exist. So we'll see.
Yeah.
So primarily I was there to work on that and also to like see what else could be built out of that. And I got to work a lot with some artists that had been at Hallmark forever, which was cool, just because usually when you first get into Hallmark, you have a mentor, but pretty much that's it, kind of thing, where I got to work with like six or seven different dudes that were like master, which is the top artist level at Hallmark, which was cool to see, because like obviously like they're the most open about like, this is what Hallmark does well, this is what Hallmark does bad, these are the good things, this is what you can get away with, these are the things you can't get away with. So like from day one, I was just kind of like on a cheat pass to like figure out my way throughout the company in a good and bad way.
It is still so hard to wrap my head around the fact that someone could be a master artist at a greeting card company.
Yeah.
That's, which is awesome. So how long did this job last?
Before... I was there about 4 years.
Okay. And we left and, because we're like just pissed. We don't want to do greeting cards.
Hallmark did a lot of downsizing. So okay. I was in a new product development before I left, I was in a new product development area and they just kind of like got rid of that department. So I could have floated over to e-cards and just done e-cards primarily, but that was kind of also dying off. So I decided to come back to California.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend at the time, who I had the whole time I was there, and my wife now, was in LA. So I decided to come back to LA and to be with her and to find a job in animation. Yeah, which was initially the intent the whole time. And then it took a little bit. And then eventually Tony hired me to work in games.
Awesome. So that's a cool thing. Tell me about at some point along this before we get to working with Tony in animation.
Yeah.
Where did toys kind of pick up?
That's actually a perfect point. So somewhere in, like, I'm a huge fan of Tim Biskup. And Tim Biskup is what started me for getting toys. That's why I brought him up earlier. So I was really collecting a lot of his toys, which had been released a few years prior, kind of thing. So I was really playing catch up on collecting Tim Biskup toys when I started, probably 2008, 2009-ish. And around that same time, my friend Ralph Cosentino got a job at Hallmark. And he was like, you've got to get on Skullbrain. And so he got me onto Skullbrain, which is Super 7's message board, basically, for like soft vinyl, primarily Japanese vinyl, whatever you want to call it, kind of thing. And obviously at the time, like, Skullbrain was big. It was pre-Instagram days. It was fun. It was a headache. Both pros and cons come out of it, kind of thing. I met a lot of people through it. I never had an issue with it, kind of thing, but like a lot of people do talk shit about it or have a problem with it. And it's really kind of irrelevant today because of Instagram or any other Discord channel or whatever you want to go to and look at toys, kind of thing. It still exists. It's still fun. There's still some dudes on there that come in from time to time, but primarily it's kind of a ghost town compared to 2009, 2010, even up to like 2015, kind of thing.
That's so crazy. I think in doing research for other episodes, I've gone through old message boards like Rebel Scum.
Yeah.
And it is such a ghost town now that you can find like posts from like 2015 with an easy click. I don't have to go through a lot. It was like all of a sudden we stopped using it and just pivoted. So tell me about...
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this. Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait. Salvation! Hooray! We're saved, DLV2! Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys!
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures!
DKE!
Those toys that you started collecting, was it all from interacting with people on Skullbrain? Just whatever you could get your hands on?
Here and there. A lot was... like finding it on eBay or Tim Biskup would do like a yearly sale kind of thing. And I'd buy directly from him for a few things. And then, but yeah, primarily most of it was secondary, especially a lot of the Japanese vinyl, like the stuff he did in collaboration with Gargamel. A lot of that would be Skullbrain and or eBay, or I'd find it 10 years later kind of thing. Yeah. It's super rare, but it's one of those things where like I wasn't really collecting before this because I just had no money.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I'm like fresh out of college, broke, and then suddenly like I have a steady job for a few years, and it's like, well, now I can really take off. But yeah, Ralph really, I don't say he's to blame, but he's to blame for my current addiction.
That conversation with your girlfriend, who is now your wife.
Yeah.
When you first start collecting, because you guys did long distance that whole time.
Yes.
And so you are now, is she also a collector of things?
I wouldn't say she's, I'd say she's more of a collector because I'm a collector.
Okay.
But she definitely goes in phases of collecting certain things. She definitely says parts of my collection are hers. Like we have a huge like alien xenomorph collection.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She claims all of that. It technically is all hers. I think I definitely wouldn't collect as much of it if she wasn't collecting all of it, kind of thing. So it feeds into that. And then we have like a whole girly collection, like a lot of Sun Guts girls and Paul Kaiju girls and a few 3A girls and stuff like that. That is really, she's taken as her collection kind of thing, where it's like, it's cute, but it's also not super cute kind of thing.
Yeah. I do like that dynamic. All the stuff that you see on my walls and all my collection, I've just notified my wife that if I die, here's people that you should call to come get it, because you're not going to want to deal with it. So you start collecting there, you move back. Tony hires you.
Yeah.
How does Tony know about you? Do you apply for this job, or are you so good at greeting cards he knows you?
Well, I applied blind. Like I knew the company and I knew what they did, but like this specific job was for 2D animation, basically Flash or whatever Flash was becoming with Adobe and potentially other 2D type of stuff. So I interview with Tony, not knowing him at all, kind of thing. So thankfully it went well and we still get along.
Yeah. And as you're doing this animation, are you working directly for him, with him, somewhere in there?
So we're on a team.
Okay.
There's like 4 or 5 artists and 4 or 5 programmers. And one of the programmers is like not the CEO of the company, but second in command. So it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Because it's a pretty big company. But basically they had created a small division of, we want to make Facebook and mobile games, because Facebook and mobile games are getting really big at this time, kind of thing. And we could see having a place in there. And so for about 5 years, that's what Tony and I did. Yeah.
Are you to blame for Farmville?
No. Farmville existed prior to this.
Okay.
Farmville was, well, and that's why I say Facebook and mobile games, because Facebook games were kind of like at their peak, kind of almost hitting like a downturn, and mobile games were starting to like really rise up in terms of like innovative, fun, different type games. We made like a Pokemon clone game is what the first game we made. Yeah.
Awesome. As you're working, you're collecting, and you start getting toys shipped to work, which by the way, I do. And I've already warned my boss currently, I'm about to get a giant shipment from China. And I said, good luck. If I'm not there, put it in my office.
All right.
So tell me about like those. And then Tony has to ask, I'm assuming, around in that point. So you're starting to collect more and more as you moved here. You're doing that stuff. Tell me about that whole process as you.
There was one time when I went on vacation for like 4 or 5 days.
Okay. Not that long.
And I come back and they literally stacked like 10, 12 boxes.
Holy geez.
Like at my desk, just yeah. completely covered like my entire desk. So yeah, there was definitely a lot being delivered, and obviously some of it's like tiny stuff, some of it's bigger stuff kind of thing. But yeah, there was definitely a few times where I was getting too many toys delivered to work.
Did you open
getting
them
too many toys delivered in general? I should.
Yeah. Say. I have learned that if I get something delivered at work, I take it into my office just to remind myself what it is. First of all, like I open it, I never open it in front of people. Like the main thing that I collect is Ninja Turtle bootlegs. It's really hard to explain why I am having an ugly toy delivered to the office. So yeah, but to be only gone only 4 days and to have 10 or 12 boxes is that's something.
It might have been more than 4 days.
Okay. So, and it's all vinyl, right? All.
Yeah, I'm pretty much exclusive to. Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, vinyl.
When you're collecting these things, at some point, I mean, in talking with Mark Nagata, he's told me about like some of the things that people chase. So there's the Hawaiian colorways. There's all these different things. And then like with the original Godzilla, there's like a bajillion variants based off of shade and color and hue and all these things. How into it are you at this point before it keeps progressing?
That was probably that was probably the peak of my collecting is when I'm getting a couple boxes a week kind of thing delivered. Okay. That's probably the hardest I've gone. And it's mellowed out a lot since then. Yeah. Just because of space and because of really needing or wanting toys kind of thing, I guess. But when you bring up Mark Nagata, that's a whole nother thing. Cause that's like, he's talking vintage toys and he's talking both vintage and new toys, I guess, like Godzilla or Ultraman wise. And I don't even get into that kind of thing where it's like vintage toys is a whole nother animal that like I haven't even stepped foot into. Like I have a few vintage toys, like a Mechagodzilla and a Tetsujin kind of thing, but they're really minor and they're not expensive. And they're just because I happen to collect Mechagodzilla and Gigantor kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh, I've heard some of the prices of vintage ones.
Yeah. No, and that's what's even stepping foot into that, like that almost becomes what you have to solely collect is vintage. And you really have to chase it. Cause I know like Mark Nagata and Brian Flynn and a couple other guys, like that's what they're really about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seeing Mark's collection.
Yeah.
Hyper specific. And that is all he's about and creating his own work and stuff. At some point in collecting of the soft vinyl, having it shipped in from wherever, all over the world at points, are you starting to believe or think that you can make toys?
Empire Blister.
Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters.
19
different styles.
Two
sizes of clamshell figure cases.
Four
different bulk pack options.
Quantities of 100
sample packs available.
Empire Blisters.
Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout.
Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters.
For the longest time, I was like, I want to keep my art and toy collecting separate.
Okay.
Just because everyone that I'd seen cross over into toy making, like, it becomes more of a job in a lot of ways. And it definitely does. And now that I've stepped into it, like, it is. And you analyze toys a lot differently. Yeah. And you're like I think Buona Spoons put it the best, where like, he didn't want to see me make toys because I would stop buying his toys. And I was like, that'll never happen. And yeah, it hasn't. But at the same time, like he's definitely seen that happen, like, countless times, probably through the years that he's been a toy maker. And that probably is the case for most toy makers, is you slow down a lot in your collecting. And it's just because I'd rather make my own toy than collect 10 of these other toys, kind of thing, or yeah, 20 of these other toys. And you're basically balancing the cost of that, kind of thing. And so when I finally did get into making a toy, it was one of those things where I was like, I love this idea. It's fun. It's quirky. It's all about me. Let's do it, kind of thing. And I mm-hmm. just kind of threw myself into it. And it was, and it did happen to be like during COVID. So I was at home a lot. Obviously, animation was still working through COVID.
Yeah.
Fortunately for that part of the industry. But also, like, I was home all the time. So I started sculpting and I started messing around with fun toy ideas. And it just kind of took off from there. And I talked to Aaron of Uh-Oh Toys or Toy Art Gallery, because he does a lot of facilitating for production and a lot of back and forth between him. And he basically facilitated the production of my first Kappa toy.
Heck yeah. Yeah. Do you have one next to you?
I actually do not.
That's okay.
Actually, I can grab one. Yeah. It is bagged. So oh, Kappa, yeah. Briner. First Kappa
is such an interesting
yeah.
character that I've fallen in love with, because I don't understand him and there's so many iterations.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about toys.
Well, that's what I think is really fun about a Kappa, is you can kind of take it really goofy, really cute, really cynical
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. He has all those personality traits, where he, like, at the very least, he's a trickster. At the very worst, he's drowning children or stealing a dear soul God. Out of your butt.
Yeah. So there is between that one where he's driving something.
Yeah.
I have Chris Lee's little cutesy one. And then I saw Matt Walls from Australia just put out a rendering of one where it's holding the head of a geisha.
Yeah.
That's wild. That's all over the place.
Super hyper realistic on his.
Yeah. Which it, like, I thought it was a fun, like, when I bought Chris's, I was like, oh, this is a fun thing. And then I started seeing more and more, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is potentially not fun anymore, just really cool and dark.
it's definitely the most versatile yokai character,
mm-hmm.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
And a lot of people definitely have fun with it. And I mean, there's even Animal Crossing has Cap'n, which is the little boat guy in yeah. Animal Crossing, or the sea captain in Animal Crossing, and he's a Kappa. So you can have a lot of fun with it. You can go crazy with it. It can be a complete monster or the cutest thing you can ever imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in talks with Uh-Oh Toys.
Yep.
Have you started painting at this point, or you?
No.
Okay. So that's because I'm interested in the dynamic of, one, how did you even figure out who to talk to make toys? Because that is a different thing. I think that people, when they first enter the toy community and they, like, they walk up to your table, they'll buy your work, but they may not know if you are the one to go to make the toy. So how did you figure that out as you're collecting from these?
So I'd been collecting for years and I knew Aaron
just through
prior to this. And I knew he had facilitated a bunch of toys for other people, along with like facilitating all of Toy Art Gallery's productions kind of thing. So he was probably the easiest connection to go to. Plus he's in LA, so I can just like talk to him off the cuff. I can show him my sculpt in person. And he can give me tons of awesome feedback on it kind of thing. And so it was just made sense from a standpoint of everything all connects. But yeah, if I was new or if I didn't know anyone in toys, it would be a lot harder to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's actually one of the things that is kind of cool about the soft vinyl scene is most makers start as collectors and eventually break into it. I don't see very many just kind of jumping in and saying, hey, I'm a maker kind of thing. And I happen to be in soft vinyl because it doesn't really make sense to approach it that way. You have to be like a fan of the product before you're a maker of the product. I don't know. Like I feel like most people attack it in that way because like you have to fall in love with the medium before you understand the medium even.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is very true, one. But there's also this progression if you go from collecting, at least there is an avenue where you start in resin. And I
made a resin toy prior to all this too. So right.
So like you understand that where you start in resin, you're figuring things out, you're molding, and that's toxic as all get out, and no one should be working with a.
And I didn't cast my resin toy.
Okay.
I was like, I don't want to get into toxic stuff of casting my stuff myself. So I sculpted it and I sent it to a dude in San Diego, actually, Strafe 7.
Oh, I know Strafe. He lives not that far from me.
And he had amazing color and he was doing some wild marbles. So I was like, dude, can you cast this for me? And it worked out great.
Yeah. I think there's like the progression as we do this, and no one should have a modified explosive in their house, like a pressure pot. Yeah, that's crazy. Those are so deadly and we just all use them flippantly like it's nothing. You move into like soft vinyl, you have a leg up because you've been collecting for so long. And I think that you're right about you have to become a collector before you start making in it. And I had bought a couple pieces before I helped someone make theirs. And I just fell in love with the history of like how it's made and where it comes from and early toys and making this like little Sifubi zine to kind of figure out all that stuff. And I fell in love with it, and it's weird. And it's just a crazier, different community that you fall in love with.
Yeah, it definitely has a lot of nuances and has like a really handmade, like grassroots feel to it. Like a lot of the makers are super approachable, even if like you feel they're like really big makers, like they're still super approachable and they're still the ones that are like selling you their product, like personally kind of thing at events and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it has like that going for it. And a lot of the makers I've become friends with over the years just because of long time collecting kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes really a good fun community on top of like just collecting. Like I can't see myself collecting really anything else. Like if I was collecting action figures, it would feel so different. And maybe I'd be more attached to that community, but it feels like so much bigger and so much more diverse. And the product is not as handmade or as personal or as touched by human hands kind of thing. So I feel that's what really drives me towards what I collect.
Yeah.
It's very character driven. It's very personal. It's very about the artist kind of thing. And I think that's also kind of what drove me to making toys rather than staying separated and just being a collector and an artist on the side kind of thing.
Tell me about the making of the first toy, that Kappa. You're going through this process for the first time.
Yeah.
You probably have some either clay model of it or you're just slowly working through what this looks like. And I tell people that first one, it feels like you just throw money into the abyss and you go from there.
I think because I was working with Aaron and I talked to Aaron so early on, it was a lot smoother for me. I had initially sculpted it about one third the size, like a really rough sculpt. And from there, I kind of worked out the kinks when I re-sculpted it larger. Mm-hmm. And I sculpted the cucumber pickle car 3 times.
Okay.
Primarily because I sculpted it as one piece the first time. And I was convinced that we could pull it through the body hole because I'd seen other pieces that were pulled that way. But Aaron basically was like, no, like pulling something 5 inches wide through a hole that's 2 inches wide or whatever is difficult, crazy, to say the least, kind of thing. So I had to re-sculpt it as 2 pieces, and figuring out how to sculpt it as 2 pieces. Because I really didn't want like a seam down the middle. I didn't want like a little in cap of a seam kind of thing. So we basically decided top and bottom kind of 2 pieces. And then like there were little things that we tweaked along the way. Like initially he had like this really like, he had a really big underbite for his beak. And since he's being pulled through the neck, like that gets really dicey. So I had to like make his underbite less and less. And then little things like thickening up his legs and stuff like that, because just thin areas tend to like not keep their shape as much and stuff like that. And just little things that like I had no clue about in terms of like production kind of thing. Because I'm like looking at my collection and I can see like 100 different variations of toys. And I'm like, oh, this is pulled through this. This is pulled through this. But I can't physically like pull it. And I can't like see all the faults that they went through going up to this. And Aaron just knew all that because of his experience. So he was really awesome in terms of working with on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which that is incredible to have someone to help you on. So we're in like 2020, 2021.
2021-ish.
Still working with Tony?
No. Okay. I'm in TV animation at this point.
Okay. Yeah. TV animation. doing something that kind of correlates with what initially drove you to it?
Prop design, TV animation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you're kind of doing now creating in two spaces. Toys and this, especially with your first toy, how are you starting to separate your creative energy and what you're willing to give out on both sides?
It's interesting because I think of sculpting and drawing as completely separate, like creative, creative outlets. And so I have been drawing my whole life kind of thing. So like it kind of comes second nature. It's something that I've fine-tuned. My skill set is like I'm very comfortable with, I'm very professional with. Mm-hmm. I've had several jobs at this point that are me drawing all day kind of thing. So I just have the hours in that, where like sculpting, I'm more forgiving with myself because it's more a Ashen Project, and it's more like this is the skill level that I'm at today, and I'm still learning kind of thing mm-hmm. in terms of sculpting. And sculpting is also inherently more soothing to me, which seems weird because it should be more frustrating because I'm still learning it and I'm still like growing. Well, not that I'm not growing. I'm growing faster at sculpting because I'm newer to it, where mm-hmm. I'm growing slower at drawing because I've been doing it for so long.
Yeah.
If that makes sense from an artist standpoint. So I find sculpting a lot more soothing, and it's such a different thing than drawing. Mm-hmm. So separating them is really kind of easy for me. So yeah, I think that's the case too. If I had done it earlier on in my career, it might feel different because separating like work life and home life in animation yeah. or in any art job is pretty tough. But over the years, I've kind of grown used to this is my job. So if they want me to redo the whole thing, that's just them wanting me to redo the whole thing. It's not like on me. It's just not exactly what they wanted. They've seen what I can give them, but they want something completely different or whatnot kind of thing. So, there's also that comes into play where I take a little bit of ownership over my actual job, but I don't take complete ownership over it because it's a bigger production. There's more people with their hands in the pot, like fixing and changing and manipulating everything about it, which is nice because it's also a team effort and like you have a whole crew there to back you up. And that's where toy making is fun and also different and so much crazier. Because it's like, this is me. This is my thing. This is what I would do if it was all about me kind of thing, which is scary to say, but also fun to say. And that's also a reason why I didn't want to get into toy making from the start too, is just that idea of like, that's scary because you're putting yourself 100% out there mm-hmm. without like a safety net or anything. Willingly.
Which is, it is scary in that, because especially with the market and how it fluctuates.
Yep.
If you're not in this for the love of the game and you're just in it for money, good luck. Good luck.
I don't really think anybody that's doing it is really in it for money.
That's
they
the
just
hope.
Happen to get lucky.
Yeah.
And become successful at it. And those, like, if you look at it, the big picture, it's very few and far between.
Yeah.
Either those people get jobs professionally, that get to make toys full time professionally, or they, as an independent artist, hit big for a number of years.
Yeah.
And continue to be successful, hopefully.
Yeah. When you are in the middle of this, the design with the Kappa, at what point do you pick up an airbrush?
I did not airbrush until I actually had vinyl in hand.
Nice. Okay. So is that how you learned?
So I started, I was like, okay, here's a few toys that I can paint.
Okay.
That are unpainted. They're cheap. They're stuff I'd like to paint. Let's just do it kind of thing. And so I started painting, and I have a few friends and toy makers who gave me a bunch of tips. There's a thread on Skullbrain that has a bunch of information. I mean, Rich, Mutant Vinyl Hardcore, basically spells it out of equipment you need, how to paint, et cetera, et cetera. Huge resource, probably from like 2007 or something. but I mean, he is one of the best painters out there. So like, you're basically learning from him through this thread. And so I start painting, and there's a lot of interesting like techniques with airbrushing, and a lot of like nuances with airbrushing, but at the same time, a lot of it is your application and your color sense. Mm-hmm. So coming at it from being an artist for X number of years and working professionally for X number of years, I'm bringing that color sense, and I'm bringing the idea that I can learn new tools quickly because I've been able to adapt and adjust and work through like a lot of different programs quickly. So learning to use an airbrush actually came a lot faster for me than I'd say most people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends who had been airbrushing for years were like, I think you've been airbrushing behind our backs kind of, but for 6 months kind of thing. And really I hadn't. It was one of those things where like I picked it up. I could study like an existing toy and understand like, this is where the airbrush is aimed, this is why it's getting overspray here, et cetera, kind of thing. And it's really just thinking about it like a light source. Is how I like to describe it. And you're basically shining like a spotlight or a colored light on the object and saying, that's where paint's going to hit. If I shine the spotlight on this area, it's going to hit like that.
Yeah.
If you're doing directional sprays kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then just having good color sensibilities, again, going back to Tim Biscuit, who's the master of all color. Kind of thing, and growing up and like studying all these different artists and having like an education traditionally in illustration kind of gave me a sense of being able to do it a lot quicker and easier than a lot of people, I guess. I don't know. Like it's hard for me to describe because like a lot of my friends were like, you're picking this up fast. I was nowhere near this when I first started. And I'm like, I don't know what to say. Like a lot of the problems I had early on were just technical issues. Like forgetting to like release the trigger when I stopped spraying, so that when I started spraying, I'd get splatter kind of thing. So a lot of it was like little technical issues like that, or not knowing exactly like what PSI to be set at. So like, when I first started, I wasn't even setting the PSI kind of thing, and it was just chaos. But I quickly like learned, set it at 25, set it at 20, set it at 15 sometimes.
Yeah.
To really get it. And obviously, like that's all up to the individual artist what they want to do with that. But overall, like I feel like because I've seen a lot of toys and because I've been a professional working artist, picking up an airbrush was a lot quicker for me.
Yeah. At what point do you make Secret Handshake Toys as like the overarching thing? And then how many toys have we made underneath that? So you got a two-parter right there.
All right. So I started Secret Handshake Toys about 2019.
Okay.
I think 2019 Kappa. DCon, my booth was officially called Secret Handshake Toys.
Okay.
Before that, it was Nocturnally Geeky Me, which is an acronym for my wife's name. Because we had been doing a DCon booth for a few years. And it primarily was collaborating with artists and selling their toys with a print that we made, or a zine, or kind of whatever. Mm-hmm. So for a while I wrestled with the brand Sifubi Ruined My Life,
mm-hmm.
and Secret Handshake Toys, but I didn't like, I like Sifubi Ruin My Life as like a side thing where like, it's more of a joke. It's more just like a fun
it's a shirt thing
to do. It's yeah. And I made, I've made patches and pins and stickers.
Yeah.
And I've played with Sifubi Save My Life as well. So, there's a bunch of that kind of stuff out there, but I think as far as a toy brand, Secret Handshake Toys is a lot more fun. And the initials SHT are just stupid because it's basically shit.
Yeah.
And I had friends of mine who were like, is it supposed to be shit? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're like, we didn't think you were that kind of humor. And I'm like, well, it's there. It's out there.
Yeah.
And there were a few people that were like, can you just do Secret Handshake? And then it's the shh. And I'm like, but it's funnier with shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is funny. To do that at the conventions and do in partnership is one of my favorite things about the toy community, that you, if you don't want to make a toy or paint a toy, you don't really have to, if you just merge your skill set with whatever's happening. And I love that. So you make those toys, you have the Kappa. Do you keep doing, like, have you been to DCon to table since after COVID?
Yes.
Okay.
Just once. Okay. The last year it was in Anaheim was my last time.
Okay.
Last year in Vegas was the first time I hadn't tabled in a while. So is that 2023?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2023.
Yeah.
Would be the last time I did DCon, and that was the first time my Kappa was available at DCon.
Awesome.
Yeah. so yeah.
And then you've produced toys since then.
I have Gordo, which is my new toy.
Yeah.
And it just came out.
Saw it at Kaijufornia.
Yeah, that was the premiere, was at Kaijufornia, and then I followed that up with the week after with Gam Jam.
Heck yeah. Did you fly out or did you send him?
Yeah, we flew out. I love flying out to Portland for the weekend, and Buona puts on one of the craziest, most fun tiny shows. I feel like he knows everyone in the industry, and people send him stuff like crazy. And it's just like, how are you getting this? You're friends with everybody kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it makes it worth the trip to see like all these toys you normally wouldn't see.
Yeah.
Except maybe at DCon, but in such a small space, like it's fun.
Yeah.
I like it. It's my favorite little con. I hope he continues to do it.
Happens every year, once a year, right?
Yeah. This is the fourth time.
Okay.
I've been to three, and, every year he says it's going to be his last.
Yeah.
So who knows? You might never get to go to it, or it might happen again. You just have to bug Buona.
Yeah. As you're doing this, Gordo gets made.
Yeah.
Now that you know the lingo, you know all the stuff that you need to do with factory stuff. Are you doing this yourself or are you walking through someone else again?
So I loved working with Aaron. I would definitely work with him again. But animation's kind of hit a little dry spell. So I've been unemployed for a little bit and have a lot of free time. So I decide to do it on my own. Plus, on Instagram, there's been like seven different factories that have hit me up in terms of like, hey, do you want to make a toy? Hey, do you want to make a toy? We can do everything. And like they go down their list of like production, mold making, wax, etc., etc., down to like, we can even do design for header cards for you. And I'm like, all I need is mold and wax and then pull the vinyl color that I want kind of thing.
And they're like, oh, boring, but okay, we'll do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so like, so I feel like in the past 2 to 3 years, and the idea that I have a toy out there kind of just says, hey, this guy makes toys. I feel like more people have reached out to me in terms of like making toys. And so I kind of wanted to see like if I could do it on my own kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just to like jump in a little bit deeper and see like the positive and negative sides of all that. Cause like with my Kappa, it's like, hey, I want these colors. And a month later, those colors show up. And like, I don't see anything in terms of like any of the other production process kind of thing.
There's something cool about that.
And no, it alleviates a huge headache, especially if your time is preoccupied with a bunch of other things. But like I said, my time wasn't preoccupied with anything. So I just kind of wanted to dive in. Plus, yeah. I'd seen like Chris Lee doing it himself, and my friend Ralph Cosentino doing it himself, and like all these other people that had experience like actually jumping in and doing the production process. So I kind of wanted to add that.
Yeah.
Both ways. Completely legitimate. Like, I think it's just how much time do you have kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so like if my time gets all sucked up in my day-to-day work, my actual job, then I know I can jump back in with Aaron and have Aaron run production for me kind of thing. But if my time is a little bit freer, then I can just jump on and do it myself kind of thing. And I think having and knowing both is cool, but if you're doing it for the first time, definitely jump in with somebody else.
Yeah.
Because it alleviates a lot of headaches and it alleviates like a lot of questions, because you're basically getting their knowledge mm-hmm. from day one.
I think the ability to speak the same language has been helpful in the learning process. And then working with artists to bring their toys to life is fun, because you get to, I don't know, every artist has their own idiosyncrasies. Like, every artist does things a little differently. And when it comes to soft vinyl, it's having to explain to them, like, this corner on the toy will never pull. Like, we got to figure out a different way.
Yeah.
And then for them to say, like, I don't understand what you mean. And I think that's a really cool process. So how many, I mean, it's a bummer that animation's kind of taken a back seat. That's always tough. I think that, I mean, we can see the animation, how it's died down over the years of like different studios or whatever, putting out whatever, and fear of AI and all that stuff. But
I think it'll definitely pick up in the future. It's one of those things where it goes and fluctuates a lot. Yeah. Like, I think part of it was just the idea that it was the only thing being made during COVID. Mm-hmm. So you saw a huge increase in animated shows, and you saw a lot of actors and actresses jumping into animation for the first time to do voice acting. And so like, you saw like a big boom, and it's just kind of like leveling out from there, I think. And we're seeing that level out. Obviously the economy's kind of and everything's kind of right now. So like, animation's also kind of
Yeah. I think I've been telling people, cause I get messages of like, I want to make a toy.
Yeah.
Awesome. I would hold back just for a little bit. Like, just maybe have some stability in the economy before we send thousands of dollars to China or Japan or wherever you're going. So what is next then with Gordo releasing?
Yep.
You have the Kappa. What is next as far as shows or releases or new toy? What's up for Secret Handshake Toys?
Yeah, that's all up in the air. So Gordo is brand new. So he's kind of my focus right now. I'll definitely have him at DCon. I'll probably carry around a few one-offs, and then Toy Art Gallery will have the release of him for their booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't really thought a lot beyond that. I do have a little unlucky cat toy, which is basically a ghost lucky cat, which I haven't really promoted at all. Okay. But he's like a finger puppet sized toy. So he's kind of just sat at my booth and kind of been there for people to see, but I haven't really like said anything about him because Gordo's been my main focus.
Yeah.
So I'll probably have a bunch of him at DCon. And he's actually being made in the USA.
Awesome.
Pulled by Dr. Doomtone. And so I think that just gives me like a little bit more options in terms of like seeing production in the US and maybe doing like more smaller production stuff,
mm-hmm.
like, or potentially different, like different heads, different arms, different pieces here and there to like do in like micro runs. Cause while I have like my big base toy, I like the idea of basically also being able to be like, what if he had this arm though? Or what if this character had this head instead? And I feel like doing stuff small time or smaller time in some dude's garage or basement or wherever he does it, allows me for a little more flexibility to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more just for me to have fun than anything. Yeah. I guess really the whole thing is just me having fun more than anything at this point too. So, but beyond that, like I haven't thought of my next plan for a toy. I have like three or four ideas, but that are like coming up immediately that I really want to make. But I like to let ideas marinate for a little bit, probably too long, as it was like a nice 2-year span between my first and second toy.
Yeah.
So hopefully my next toy is a little bit sooner than that, but also I like to really think about stuff because like I'm basically like I get in my head of basically like the idea of this is going to be a permanent thing. People are going to own this, people are going to have it in their collection.
Yeah.
I'm going to have it on my shelf, and I know it's not ever going to be perfect, but at the same time I want it to be as close as possible.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. And I'm still in the process of revealing the little driver under Gordo's head. So I think that's my big plan for this week is probably tomorrow. And by the time this gets out, it'll be out there. Is the idea that Gordo has this little Tanuki driver under his head, which I didn't reveal on the first release, and the second release will have a clear head, so it will definitely show it off.
Awesome.
Yeah.
David, the last part of the podcast is where you can promote where people get your stuff and all that. And the booth, I know we said Toy Art Gallery will have Gordo at DesignerCon.
Correct.
You'll be making an appearance out there, walking around with some one-offs.
Yep.
So please tell us how we can get in contact if we want to get in contact or anything like that.
Yeah, so I'm primarily just on Instagram. David J. Kaufman is my main Instagram. Secret Handshake Toys is my secondary Instagram. Everything gets double posted on both if it's the toys I make. So that's why Secret Handshake is kind of just my secondary. But if you want to see my collection and the toys I make, at David J. Kaufman. Yeah.
Heck yeah. David, thank you for coming on Toys on Tap.
Thank you.